This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
The BFM Breakfast Grill, connecting you to the top people and ideas. Presented by U Mobile.
Good morning, I'm Noelle Lim. We speak with Afoso Ojomo, the Global Prosperity Lead at the Clayton Christensen Institute for Disruptive Innovation. He is also co-author of the book Prosperity Paradox, How Innovation Can Lift Nations Out of Poverty. When we think about economic development, instead of seeing this as a development problem, we could approach it as an innovation problem. So this interview is really timely as we talk about shared prosperity in Malaysia and the process of creating wealth. What is the prosperity paradox?
It's an oxymoronic statement. It's sort of something where if you're trying to do good, you might end up doing more harm than good. Prosperity paradox explains a concept that you actually don't create prosperity and you don't eradicate poverty by trying to eradicate poverty. If anything, you actually might actually get it worse. Instead, you create prosperity by investing in innovation, a specific type of innovation that we call market-creating innovation, as disruptive innovations. But we explain how that type of innovation can actually create new markets that transform the economic development prospects of entire nations, really.
Some cases you mentioned, Celtel, Africa, Tolerum, as well as Henry Ford. Now, for them to be really successful, they had to invest a lot in infrastructure to create the kind of market that we speak about. It does require a lot of capital.
Yes, it does. But if I may step back a bit and just try to explain that not all innovation is created equal, the different types and how they can impact organizations and economies. So the first type are efficiency innovations, very common. It sort of helps you do more with less. So when you outsource operations, you invest in automation. Those efficiency innovations free up cash flows. They make a company or a region very competitive. But they by themselves don't really create vibrant economic development. If anything, they might actually destroy jobs, right? Because if you outsource, you might get jobs created in a different country or a different region, but you take jobs away from one region. So those are efficiency innovations. The second type are sustaining innovations. They're also important. And these types of innovations help you make good products better. And so think about your phone, for instance. If you have a smartphone and you have a new camera on the smartphone or more memory, we go from 4G to 5G. You have a new car, you get heated seats in your car, adaptive cruise control. All those features that make good products better are what we call sustaining innovations. They help companies make a little bit more money in the industries and with the customers they already serve. They don't necessarily create new markets. The third type, which is really what we focus on in our book, The Prosperity Paradox, or what we call market-creating innovations. And these are innovations that transform complicated and expensive products into products that are simple and affordable. Now, and so when you do this, you create an entirely new market for people in a region. And so you mentioned a few companies, Celtel, with they've created cell phones in many countries in Africa. You mentioned Tolaram, made noodles a staple food in Nigeria. Now they're expanding all across Africa. And Henry Ford democratized cars, right? Cars were things that were available to only wealthy people 120 years ago today. Many people across the world can access cars. Now, the thing about market-creating innovations is they are not simply a product or a feature. It's an entire system because you're creating a new market for people who historically did not have access to the product. And so you will, to borrow your language, you will need to invest in infrastructure. And so you're absolutely correct about that. But here's the thing about it. While the infrastructure investment might start off as a cost center to many businesses, they will ultimately end up becoming a profit center, largely because when you create value by providing this infrastructure, other companies that want to participate in this new market that you've created will also want a piece of the infrastructure that you've just developed. And so to give you a quick example with Tolaram, who you mentioned, they are now the largest corporate logistics company in Nigeria. The reason is they had to build a logistics arm to get their noodles from point A to point B. And now that other companies see that, oh, wow, we could actually hire Tolaram's logistics systems, logistics is now a profit center in their operations. I will say that ultimately ends up becoming a profit center.
Would you consider a company like, say, Uber or WeWork market-creating companies?
You know, I will... Not really. At the core of WeWork, it's really a real estate company. And you begin to see that as the company is trying to go public and people are really looking into their books, you know, I mean, they've been devalued. I believe they were at, what, $40, $50 billion, now looking at maybe 10 to 15. It's a real estate company. And the way you know that is, you know, If a company says, you know, we're a software company, take the software out of their business model, see how it operates. If you take the real estate out of WeWork's business model, they really have no business. They are at the core a real estate company that provides extra wraparound services, but you take real estate out and they have no business. Now, with Uber, Uber is interesting because, again, at the core of Uber's business model is getting people or products in terms of Uber Eats, Uber deliveries, from point A to point B. Now, if you really take a step back and assess that business model in terms of creating an entirely new market for people who historically did not have access to transportation, I don't see Uber as a market-creating innovation. And quite frankly, they are having a hard time figuring out how to make money. The CEO in the last earnings call said, look, this is going to be a long haul. And I've gone on record as saying, if they do not fundamentally change their business model, I don't see how Uber will ever make money, largely because at the core of it right now, it's a transportation company. And so these have expanded the market for transportation and workspace. They've expanded it, but they have not fundamentally created an entirely new market that drastically reduced the price of the product for people.
I wonder if it makes a difference where this innovation takes place. Say in a country like Indonesia, where the public infrastructure, transportation is still not that robust yet. There's huge traffic jam, but there are a lot of motorbike riders. So companies like Gojek create a lot of jobs in a way, or part-time work opportunities for the riders. It depends on the economy that this innovation takes place. So maybe like Gojek might be a market-creating opportunity in Indonesia, but not in the US?
Absolutely, Noah. Absolutely. So Gojek is a brilliant company. I'm glad you brought that up. If you go back to the history of transportation in Japan, for instance, right, you will find two-wheelers sort of coming onto the scene, and South Korea as well, two-wheelers, three-wheelers, and four-wheelers. Now, the reason that's important is the cost structure of a car is entirely different from that of a motorcycle, right? A motorcycle is a lot more affordable. It's a lot more affordable to buy. It's a lot more affordable to maintain, to fuel, and move around, right? And so you in an economy that maybe is not as wealthy as Norway or Sweden, some of those, you can see how getting access to a motorcycle, creating a small business, getting people around, being part of that platform can create significant value, especially in an economy where, to your point, the infrastructure has not yet caught up with the demands in the economy. Now, when you fast forward to a more developed society where there are many options, in fact, in America, almost 9 out of 10 households have cars. I think it's 865 cars for every 1,000 people. You begin to see how the business model of Uber would look different, of sort of a sharing platform would look different here than in Indonesia or Thailand or somewhere else. And so you've hit a nail on the head, which is market creating innovations are context specific, right? They are context specific. Now, if you create a new market in, say Nigeria, it doesn't mean that similar innovation would be a market creating innovation in the U.S. or somewhere else. So I think you're absolutely right about that.
We are speaking with Efoso Ojomo, the Global Prosperity Lead at the Clayton Christensen Institute for Disruptive Innovation. He's also the co-author of the book, The Prosperity Paradox. After this, we'll speak about how these ideas of prosperity paradox are applicable to Malaysia.
You are listening to the BFM Breakfast Grill, brought to you by U Mobile.
Welcome back. We are speaking with Efoso Ojomo, the Global Prosperity Lead at the Clayton Christensen Institute for Disruptive Innovation and co-author of the book, The Prosperity Paradox. So in Malaysia, people and businesses are very comfortable and we're like in this middle income category, or some people call it middle income trap. So what is the role of government if it wanted to accelerate innovation, or do you think governments should take a back seat?
There are two ways to think about government. One is through the lens of the fast-growing East Asian nations. I think those countries that were able to invest a lot in innovation, in infrastructure, and the governments had a very sort of heavy hand in directing some of those investments. Not every decision they made was good, and by the East Asian, fast-growing East Asian, I guess tigers, you could, you know, Hong Kong, Singapore, South Korea, Taiwan. Not every decision was good, but there was sort of a mandate. We are going to prioritize economic development. Now, what ultimately happens is that when you have the government in something, the government grows bigger and bigger. But at the same time, you also have governments in the West. And there's a professor out of Harvard Kennedy School, Danny Roderick, who did some research saying, look, the bigger a country gets in terms of its economy and its exports, the bigger its government gets as well. And so the role of government really is to figure out ways to help its industries become as efficient as possible. That's it. It's not to create protectionist policies that enable its industries to get fat and to get lazy. It's to help local industries become as efficient as possible. And one way to think about it is for a government to ask itself this question: am I helping my local companies become more profitable, or am I helping them become more productive? See, when you look at productivity, the question you ask is, how many people can we reach with the resources we have? As opposed to when you look at profitability, it's how much money can we make with the resources we have? Two entirely different questions, because I could be very profitable and not productive. You know, if I create regulatory barriers so that competition doesn't come into the fold, I could be profitable, but maybe not as many Malaysians have access to healthcare. But if the government comes into the healthcare space and says, look, this is what we want for Malaysia. We want every single citizen to be within 5 miles of a pharmacy and a primary healthcare hospital, so you know, or you know, 10 miles from an emergency room, so that when there are accidents, this happens. That is a productivity play, so that the companies in that space, they go and figure out how to solve that problem, and the government can provide incentives. As opposed to just creating regulations that leave out innovators and disruptors and leave the bigger companies to keep getting fat and profitable and wealthier. So I think that's one place government could play a very, very important role.
So how would you overcome this? Like, how do you get governments to start shifting their regulations and being more flexible?
Man, if I knew the answer to that question, I might be a billionaire right now. Governments are a very interesting and unpredictable entity. I think we have to start there. The government meets with people in the private sector in that space every week, every month. I would prefer every week, because if the government makes the private sector more productive, they will make more money as far as taxes go, and And they would ultimately have to do less. That's really just the truth. And so if you think about the government's job as really making sure there is a vibrant, thriving private sector that creates value and invests in innovation, then there needs to be a constant dialogue going on between the two entities. So meet every week and discuss what are the struggles that the private sector is having going across the border and getting to Indonesia, getting to just every country in the region. How do we make you a global powerhouse? Those should be the questions the government should be asking, right? So that's one. The second is understanding that there is a beautiful, maybe it's not beautiful, but there is a predictable relationship between innovation and regulation. Innovation precedes regulation, right? So you cannot regulate what you don't have. And so think about it simply, right? You don't have traffic laws if you don't have roads, and you don't have roads if you don't have cars, right? So the cars come, and then you need roads, and then you need traffic laws. In many low middle income countries, unfortunately, regulation precedes innovation. And regulation precedes innovation largely because regulations are a lot easier to copy than innovations. And so a government can look at the quote unquote the best laws in America, in Norway, in France, and say, oh, those are good laws. They make sense on paper. Let's copy those laws. It's good to have those. And then you copy them, and then that stifles innovation. Without realizing that those regulations and laws have evolved over time to fit the needs of the people in the market, right, where they were created. And so it's important for governments to understand that the contextual nature of their own regulations is key to helping local innovators create solutions that reach as many non-consumers as possible. The last thing I'll say is for governments to also be aware that, you know, regulation and corruption are two sides of the same coin. You know, every regulation you create that is not going to be easily and strongly enforceable will create an opportunity for corruption. It does not necessarily have to lead to corruption all the time, but it will create an opportunity for corruption. And so before you make a new law, it's important to understand how that law will incentivize people in the government to actually be corrupt. And in some cases, it's better to not have a regulation or a law at all.
You also say businesses can help create more wealth for people, not just the owners. But we've seen in countries like the Philippines where large family-owned businesses protect their interests at the detriment of newcomers. And in Hong Kong, people have been protesting against the high cost of living and income inequality. When might the prosperity paradox fail?
There is definitely a role for government. I want to be clear about that. In our book, we say it's a sequencing problem. There are many instances where the government says we're going to loosen regulations, help a company become productive, and then the company gains a monopoly and they befriend the government and all hell breaks loose and there's no competition and so on. But what we really are trying to describe is how most of today's prosperous countries became prosperous. And they did not become prosperous because the governments woke up one day and said, you know what, we need to create systems that encourage competition, systems where people's values are respected. What happened was you had organizations create new markets, employ a lot of people, and those people began to fight for their rights. General Motors workers are on strike. They're on strike because they want demands from General Motors that aren't being met. Now, if General Motors did not decide to create a new market for cars where it employed tens of thousands of people, about 50,000 workers are on strike, right? Those workers would not be able to organize the way they've now been able to organize and say we demand more. And when you look at the evolution of labor practices, the evolution of institutional development and better laws, it has always come as a result of people being able to come together, organize, and demand more from the government. But it just so happens poor people are limited in their ability to come together and organize because they don't have the resources to. And I think that's sort of where, if we invest in innovation first, create new markets, develop some prosperity, that prosperity now begins to go back and forth with the government. And so in some ways, I think the prosperity paradox, at least the solution to it, is playing out pretty well in Hong Kong, because they are protesting, saying, look, enough is enough. Now, we can debate on what the actual issue is with regards to Hong Kong and the protests. But I think what you see is not a society where everything happens smoothly. What you see is a society where when the protests happen or when the demands against the powers that be happen, they're more successful because the people who are protesting or people who want those demands are now more prosperous. It's an evolutionary process that happens over time. It doesn't just, you don't invest in market creating innovations today and prosperity comes tomorrow. I think it evolves over time. And what we saw in the US, in many countries in Europe, in China today, in Taiwan, South Korea, is this evolutionary process of prosperity creating more and more allowances and freedoms for people.
Thank you so much for speaking with us. That was Efoso Ojomo, the Global Prosperity Lead at the Clayton Christensen Institute for Disruptive Innovation and co-author of the book, The Prosperity Paradox. I'm Noel Lim on BFM 89.9.
The Breakfast Grill is brought to you by U-Mobile, unleashing unlimited potential every day.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.